Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. I'm WFHB News Director January Jones. Joining us in the studio, we have candidates for the District 1 seat on the Bloomington City Council, Democrat Chris Sturbaum and his Republican challenger, Casey Baker. Also coming up in the second half of the show, WFHB manager Chad Crothers will talk about election accessibility with advocate Randy Paul. Stay with us for Interchange fall election coverage here on WFHB. But right now, we begin with the candidates for a city council race. Chris and KC, thanks for joining us today on Interchange.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I wanted to explain the way city council works before we go into our discussion, just for the public knowledge here. The city council has 9 seats. 3 are what are known as at-large seats, and anybody in the city can vote for one of those 3 seats. And then there are 6 district seats, and you can only vote for the member of your district. So everybody who votes for the city council race gets to vote for the members of the at-large seats, and then their one district representative. And so Chris and KC are running for District 1. And if we could just start out with a little bit more about each of the candidates. District 1, though, let me begin with, is the Walnut Street area all the way past 37 and encompasses most of the west side. So we're talking about kind of the traditional west side of Bloomington, and it's stretching a little bit over Highway 37. So, KC, do you want to start us out with a little bit of background about yourself and why you want to run for city council and why you want to be on the council?
Absolutely. I decided to run for council back in February, mostly as a way to learn about Bloomington and to learn what the city's issues were. Having moved to the neighborhood where I live now just a couple of years ago, I'd begun to learn about what sorts of things worked, what sorts of things didn't work, and I'd come to think that getting involved was the one way to kind of address those issues. So when I looked at running, I looked at where I could make the most impact, and I saw a chance to do that in running for city council. I'm originally from southern Indiana, south central Indiana. I grew up in southern Morgan County and moved to Bloomington first in 1999 when I was an undergrad here at IU. And after graduating from IU and living away for a while, my wife and I moved back. We just love Bloomington. It's a great place to live. But we see issues in the neighborhoods that, again, concern us a little bit. And to me, the best way to get involved is to advocate for issues, occasionally to run for office, and to really just be as active as possible in government, whether that's as an advocate, whether that's as a citizen, or whether that's as an elected official. So something that's really important to me.
And you're running as a Republican from the Monroe County local party. When did you first get involved with the Republican Party?
Well, I've kind of always been a Republican. I think there are a lot of national issues and local issues. But for me, the real reason why I'm a Republican and the real reason I got involved has to do with just kind of the nature of how people perceive government. To me, government should enable people to do what they do. Sometimes I think that the other side believes that what government should do is give people the power to do that. I think it should get out of the way and allow them to do that. So for me, it's kind of a philosophical thing. It's not about a lot of the national issues. It never really has been for me, but especially at the local level, government really should be about enabling people to live their lives. For me, it's always been an ideological thing. This year's really been the first time that I've been active in the Monroe County Republican Party. I've met a lot of the folks who are activists and who have helped out, and I've gotten to know them this year. But it's really just been this year that I've gotten to know them.
Thank you, KC Baker. Now, Chris Sturbaum. Chris, you've been on the council for quite a few terms now. I'm wondering if you could just give a short description of your background and then why you want to keep serving Bloomington on the city council.
Well, I grew up on the west side in District 1, and it's kind of fun to be back in the studio because as a volunteer, I helped put up some of the trim in here, and we decided where we were going to put the dog. And my Mason friend laid the block, and anyway, I've just always been involved in what's going on in Bloomington. And I kind of waited my turn to run for this office. There was a good representative, and I was a neighborhood activist, and we didn't want a challenge in the primary. So I sort of waited my turn and worked as a preservationist. And, you know, I came up through the neighborhood associations. And in fact, my neighborhood association was the first one in Bloomington. My dad helped found it along with me and some of the other neighbors. And I learned about politics on that level. They were going to expand 3rd Street through the middle of what is now called Prospect Hill. And they were going to take out about 40 houses, essentially destroy the neighborhood I grew up in. And we learned that politics can affect the outcome and that the city government doesn't always know exactly what they're doing and they need some feedback. And we also learned that preservation law did just that. It does preserve neighborhoods. And we were the first historic district also, kind of like a chess set, moved to block, and the road couldn't get federal funding. And that's why we're on 2nd and 5th Street, and that's why that neighborhood has blossomed, because we worked to make it work. So, you know, I just gradually went to little meetings, bigger meetings, bigger meetings, and finally I had to run for council and go to all the meetings that I needed to go to help build the town back.
Well, you know, the work of a city council person, a lot of people maybe don't realize, but everybody has a full-time job, and it's very much people that want to give their time. Unlike a lot of political offices, I think the city council level and this local level is really where a lot of the work happens beyond some of the money games that get going at the bigger levels of government.
It's kind of the size that our democracy was developed on. You know, citizens who they farmed in the early days of the country, and then they served as politicians. Mm-hmm. So we who are out working, we're both business people, and we spend our spare time, and some of our time that isn't spare,
true.
Working for people in the neighborhoods because, well, speaking for myself, because I care about what happens.
And you came out of a certain time in Bloomington where there was activism, you know, around development, and that's always an issue going on here. Well, KC, you're from kind of the next generation of civil servants. What has motivated you as the next generation to get involved? What has rallied you, I guess?
Well, one of the things that really sustains me as a candidate for city council, and it's been a really tremendous experience for me because it's allowed me a chance to have access to a lot of these resources. I think a tremendous advantage that Chris has in this race is he knows the lay of the land. And one of the first things I had to do as a candidate was to learn that lay of the land. So, you know, I made the commitment that I was going to go out and walk each of the neighborhoods. There are approximately 9 neighborhoods as recognized by the city that comprised the first district, ranging from Evergreen Village and Broadview in the south all the way up to Maple Heights in the north. One of the things that's really sustained me through this process is learning how different each of those neighborhoods are. They all have a culture and a history that are kind of their own, and they each have issues that are kind of their own. So the things that I hear in Maple Heights are very different than the things I hear in my own neighborhood or that I hear in Highland Village way out west. And I think that's really interesting. It's a great part of city government that it's the part of government that touches people's lives the most. I absolutely agree with Chris. It's what our democracy is patterned on. There's certainly no money in it. So I think you really have to run because you care about the issues and you care about the people. And one of the things that I've been so fortunate to do through this process is learn about those people and learn about the issues. For me, I think every single race ought to be contested on the ballot. That's not the only reason I'm running, but one of the key reasons is that I think people need a choice. And I'm really disappointed that the only people you're interviewing are Chris and I and maybe the at-large candidates, because those are the only contested races. I think that's really sad.
Yeah, that's definitely worth noting. Changes in election law this year allowed municipalities to make that choice. And then what we de facto see is people who win in the primary kind of get less attention moving forward because they're not fighting for their seat. So,
well, I agree with Casey, and I'm glad he's come forward to run. And we are disappointed that there's not more discussion about which direction our city's going.
Well, what's the plus is that we don't have to, I guess, have the discussion in a political context, because I guess all the running is aside, and so maybe there'll be a clearer, quicker dialogue with the people who are going into office, that they didn't have to fight it through this fall, and they're going to go in ready next right. year to move forward.
Well, our big message is there is an election.
That's right.
Not that's everybody seems to clue into that, because
there's
not
the
a
message.
Big ticket ahead.
Sure, sure. We've been definitely trying to underscore the importance of people knowing that there is a city election, and it affects, I think it's 54,000 people are eligible to vote in this election here in Bloomington, and that's a substantial number of people who have diverse needs. And in speaking about that, we're talking about District 1. District 1 is full of a lot of distinct communities, not only people who have formed a neighborhood association, but also just different small pockets of communities with a range of needs. So, Chris, I'm wondering if you could tell me about some of those places in the first district that have the kind of needs that you're seeing,
right.
That you're able to help them with on
well,
the city
Crescent,
council.
Crescent Bend is a new neighborhood out by what used to be Dyer School and is now Tri-North Middle School. And, we supported as a council an affordable housing project there. And committed to solving an age-old traffic problem at 17th
oh,
and Arlington.
Yes. So Crescent, that's the neighborhood.
That's called Crescent Bend, right there around 17th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Whistler and I sort of share that district. And, we got to know those neighbors. They advocated with us, and they said, hey, if this is going to come and we're going to accept this affordable housing, we need traffic amenities. And, as long as I'd been here, in Bloomington, which is 40-some years, that's been one of the most dangerous intersections. So working to advocate for that is one. And then, in the Broadview area, there wasn't a good stop. There was actually a four-way stop, I think, at Country Club and Rogers, South Rogers. And that was one of the first things I advocated for, was get a real good intersection there. And, what comes along with those, because we're more progressive, are bike lanes and filling in some of the gaps of the trail plans, So when we get those kinds of federal funds spent on the west side, we start putting the trails back together. And then I've worked on traffic calming in about four different neighborhoods that have different needs. And I worked for some other obscure things like feral cats and putting a bird habitat at Fairview School. And gosh, there was some other little obscure business, but growing more natural yards and things like that. Everyone
that's the business of neighborhoods.
An issue.
Yeah, the business
and
of neighborhoods.
Our job, Casey's and mine, would be we're the person that they can call and say, what about this? Why is this way, and what can we do about it?
Do you find that most of the work that you've had to do has been dealing with traffic, or where's the other, I guess, maybe policy area that you've found city council to be most effective mm-hmm. in?
Well, we talk a lot about quality of life, and when the Democrats first came in the 70s, there was no planning, no zoning, no nothing. It was kind of the Wild West. So the things that I've worked toward I worked for a downtown plan which helped create a design guideline for the city. So as we build the campus of the city, it has a cohesive look. And there are height guidelines and setback guidelines and cohesive front alignment of buildings and materials get reviewed. And that never used to happen. So that happens, and that happens in the neighborhoods too in a preservation way, where people can't just do absolutely anything to their houses that could have a negative impact on neighbors and people that are around them. So we've gotten, the government has gotten more involved maybe than my respected opponent would like, but it also guides and helps kind of everybody in the long run.
So finding that balance between maintaining the character of a neighborhood and then letting people have enough control of their own property to, keep it as they right. want it, but also so that it's an asset to the city.
Right. And I'd like to talk about building the commons, but I think it's Casey's turn.
Yes, it is. Well, Casey, I asked Chris, just to remind our audience, I'm here with Casey Baker and Chris Sturbaum. You just heard Chris Sturbaum talking from his perspective, and now we'll ask Casey Baker about the same issue, talking about who is on the west side, who is in District 1, and what kind of needs do you see yourself advocating for on the policy level of the city council?
Well, I think like Chris, I absolutely agree that it's a true collection of neighborhoods. There's all sorts of interesting neighborhoods that make up the West Side. And so you can be in Broadview, and then you can be over in my neighborhood, which is just west of there, past Evergreen Village, Southern Pine, some call it. You can be out on the West Side, or you can be up on the North Side. Not only is the flavor of each community different, but really the issues are. So in Maple Heights, it's things like sidewalk maintenance and crosswalks and making sure that people feel safe. In Highland Village, it's very much transportation, and I hear a lot, why doesn't Bloomington Transit extend their service just a few really inches further out to Ivy Tech, which is where a lot of people attend classes or work, or to Cook, which is a huge employer in that part, really, of the county. But because of the dichotomy of who do I call if there's a problem, my neighbors call the county, who do I call and why do I call them? So I think there's some issues there. One of the reasons I think the West Side is so important is because you see that what's happening in Bloomington is really growth on the south and the west sides of the city. And a lot of that is southwest of the city. There are a lot of neighborhoods down by Bachelor Middle School, which are not part of the city's jurisdiction per se, but are part of the growth policies plan, which of course is the city's planning and zoning jurisdiction. And kind of on that subject, as we're talking about planning and zoning, I agree with Chris that the city, and one of the real benefits of living in a city or living in an incorporated area, is that you have a certain expectation of what your rights are and what your responsibilities are. To describe Bloomington as a Wild West in the 70s, I think we'd all agree that that's not the right place. But I think that, like a lot of things, government action is a pendulum. And there's a sense that at least from the people I'm talking to, that it's almost swung too far. I was at the Broadview Neighborhood Association meeting last night. They were kind enough to ask me to speak. And there was one neighbor who said, I didn't have any clue what I had to go through to go through the process of adding a porch to the back of my house. And I wanted to do this. It's something small. She was an elderly woman, and the city was purchasing land at the front of her property to put in a sidewalk. She's thrilled about the sidewalk, but she now has to go in her back door because she can't park in the front. She had no clue the process to go through. And her words to the whole group and to me were, I'm really intimidated by this process. I don't know who to talk to. I don't know where to go. And it was great because I got to respond to say, you go to me or you go to Chris. You go to your city councilman or city councilwoman and talk to them about what your issue is and let them guide you through that process. Let them be your access to resources. If you aren't sure, ask them. So one of the things that I've really been fortunate to do is to educate people as I'm walking. A, that there's an election, and that is tremendously important that people know that municipal government matters and the election is coming up. But B, that city government has a responsibility to them, both to respect their own rights, but also to be responsive to their concerns and neighborhoods. It's been a tremendous experience for me to learn that. And as I've gone from neighborhood to neighborhood, I've been really struck by that kind of common thread that we're not sure what's going on with city government or how we can be active in city government, but that we want to be. That's really been the really positive message that I've taken from this. People want access to their government, and they want to be participants in their government. And the ones that have done that, I think Prospect Hill is a beautiful neighborhood and a real example of what neighbors making decisions can do. I think that for that neighborhood, those things make sense. They don't necessarily make sense in Broadview or in Crescent Bend or wherever it happens to be, but they do make sense there.
Right, but you saw how different even those associations are.
Absolutely.
And that's such a good level of of access to government, mm-hmm. create that association. It's almost like the old precincts in Chicago.
You sure. know,
this is your level of starting to get involved in your government.
Well, how would you encourage citizens to get involved beyond the neighborhood association? Because I think sometimes that's a very convenient way to interface, of course, because people come together and are organized and have questions. But I'm wondering if kind of in your closing statements, if you could include just some information on how people who don't engage at that level can, you know, engage in the democratic process, one, by voting, of course, in the election this time, but really engage with you as their representative. So, Chris, if you want to start us off.
Right. Well, I get calls, and they're about little issues, and I contact people and often solve them within a day and sometimes can't solve them at all, but... You know, I know who's running things downtown, and I'm the amplifier of the little voice, and that's really our job. And are we in our closing period or not?
Yeah, I think we need to wrap up. Okay. We're running towards the end of the interview time. We've okay. got about 5 minutes. So you're saying that people...
They really should call.
Should just call.
I mean, that's their one-on-one
telephone.
They should call their representative.
Yeah,
email,
I think that's good.
You know, anyway, and then start going when there's an issue that matters to them, show up at city council. You know, there are a lot of nights when nobody's there, and I figure, okay, the ship's running just fine. And then there are nights when there are 20 or 30 people there, and they're very worried about what's happening, mm-hmm. and they're involved, and they get a public access to speak up about what's going on. And, mm-hmm. and boy, do we listen.
You sure know. Do. It's time
and
when you want to listen.
It's real good democracy mm-hmm. to see people come out and say, why are you doing this and what could we do better? And sometimes they learn something and sometimes we learn something. But that seed is there for them whenever they think we're going wrong, you know?
Yeah,
or
so multiple.
When they want to tell us that we're doing right and they want to make sure that we do what they asked us to do.
So multiple ways to engage, you guys. You're saying there's the neighborhood associations that kind of have organized contact. You are available by phone and email, mm-hmm. and that you would encourage people to utilize the city council meetings as
sure.
a way to speak up.
Yeah,
to
there's
as
even
well.
A public comment period when you can just simply stand up before the meeting, say whatever's on your mind for 5 minutes to
yeah.
council, to the city, to the world. You know, it's there for you.
Yeah, so public comment, part of City Council, and we are talking about City Council District Race 1 with Chris Sturbaum and Casey Baker, both hoping for your vote on Election Day, November 8th. We're going to wrap up with them before we bring in the second half of the show with Chad Crothers and accessibility advocate Randy Paul. So, Casey, if you want to give us kind of your closing statement and let us know how you can be accessed too, as Chris did as well, if voters have questions or concerns.
Sure. I really want to echo a lot of what Chris said. I think it is so important for me, win or lose this race. I've put myself out there and I've said I'm willing to advocate for these issues. I'm willing to speak on behalf of my neighbors and people all around the city on issues. So it is so important. I phrase it a little bit differently. Instead of contacting the city to tell them what's going on, what's good, what's bad, I think I look at it as holding us to task and holding us accountable. There are things the city government should be doing. There are things the city government shouldn't be doing. And the city government has some sense of what those are, but they can't have a really good sense of them unless they get that feedback. We see that with all sorts of issues. But one of the things that I'm just so struck by in this race is I'll knock on someone's door and I'll be asked what party I'm with, and I'll say, I'm a Republican. And I kind of cringe sometimes, depending on the neighborhood, depending on the look I get, because there's a certain note that Republicans are not maybe as prevalent here. But 9 times out of 10, people say, gosh, we need that diversity of opinion. Thank you for doing this. Some of them, I think, will come out and vote for me, and I'm so glad for that. I, of course, appreciate their support. And some of them won't. And I appreciate them, too, because I think that's what makes this work. I think that what I want to do as a candidate, what I think is so important as a candidate, is giving people that access and giving people that voice. If you don't feel like the city government is representing you, I think you have to make a choice. And if you do, I think you should also make that choice. So, you know, in addition to voting, it really does boil down to the contacts that people make, reaching out to me by phone, by email, my website, whatever way works best for people. I want to be accessible, and I'll continue to be accessible, win or lose.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We've enjoyed this dialogue. We're going to have Chris give his closing statement before we move into the second half of Interchange right here on WFHB. Chris, could you tell us your closing thoughts?
Yeah, I would just say the big issue is, have we been doing a good job? And that's what election's for, to tell us whether we are or not doing the kind of job that people expect of us. And what we've done is worked to build the commons. We've built City Hall, the Beeline Trail, the market. We've worked to keep the library downtown. These are things that only government can do to keep the commons active and alive for everyone. And it interacts with private development, private enterprise in a harmonious way, so that we benefit the people who are in business here, and the people in business here are benefited by that. And you know, what we say is that the quality of life is what's important, and it makes people want to be here. And my story, and a lot of people's story, is first, I want to be in Bloomington. Second, I'm going to make a business to be here. You know, so the being here in the first place, Brad Whistler could be anywhere, but he wants to stay here and run his business here. And he's now too busy to be a council member. He's getting so successful. And Bill Cook could have lived anywhere, but they wanted to live in Bloomington and make it the community that it is. So I hope we're doing a good job, and I welcome anyone to let us know one way or another. But the surest way is vote on election day. And, you know, if I wasn't running, I almost vote for my Mr. Baker here. He's a very nice man and a well-trained man. And I know he's going to have a future, however this election comes out in local politics. So that's my closing statement, but I'm biased, and I would like you to vote for me instead.
Well, thank you both, and it's really nice to have this dialogue. As we mentioned earlier, many of the council races for city council were determined in the spring, and so to keep the dialogue going after a long summer and a budget process has come through, too, at the city council level is really helpful to keep people's attention span, I guess, at the elections, and to remind them that there is ways to access government and participate, and the city council is kind of the first stop if you're a city resident to accessing your government and getting issues that you're concerned with taken care of. So the upcoming election again is November 8th, the Tuesday, but early voting is currently open at the Curry Building. So we would encourage people to explore their options for that. All right. Well, this is Interchange, and I'm January Jones. We've been talking to the District 1 candidates for the Bloomington City Council. Coming up after the break, we're going to have Chad Carruthers in the studio talking with Randy Paul about election accessibility issues in Monroe County. Stay with us.
Hello, and welcome back to Interchange here on Community Radio WFHB, volunteer-powered and listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana. Big thanks to both the candidates who appeared in our first segment. Tonight, for the second half of Interchange, we turn our attention to voting accessibility. My name is Chad Carruthers, and I'm in the studio here with Randy Paul. Randy Paul is a voice that is not unfamiliar to WFHB news programming listeners. He is a regular go-to guy for accessibility issues on our daily local news program. And about a year ago or so, we had Randy Paul on this very program for an entire hour in a program we called Randy Paul, Agent of Change. Randy Paul fights for people you may never think about. He's a community organizer, he's a labor activist, and he is a board member of the Friends of the Library Foundation at the Monroe County Public Library. And Randy is here to talk about the challenges facing the handicapped and other people sometimes regarded as being on the fringe of society. Last year, Randy was here in the studio telling us the amazing story of how he became the agent of change for workers at the Bloomington Access and Rural Transit bus services, galvanizing those employees to unionize despite threats and intimidation from the management. And we also did talk about problems facing handicapped citizens, and that's what we're going to focus on tonight here in the second half hour of Interchange, citizens trying to exercise their right to vote and the obstacles to voting accessibility here in Monroe County. Randy Paul, welcome back to Interchange.
Great, thank you.
So, Randy, give us a quick overview. We're gonna zero in on some of the recent meetings that you've attended and a complaint that you've filed with the HAVA Outreach Manager, HAVA's Help America Vote Act. The Indiana Secretary of State's office in Indianapolis received a complaint from you about problems with voting accessibility at early polling sites. But let's start with sort of a historical overview. This is not a new problem.
No, it's not.
In Monroe County.
Yeah, let me go back just a little bit. You know, actually, this goes back to 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed. Then it was again in 1973 when the Rehabilitation Act was passed, which basically said if you took federal funds, you had to make your site accessible. Then there's the Accessible Elderly Handicap Act in 84, the ADA in 1990, the Motor Voter Bill in 1995, and then the Help America Vote Act, which was passed by the feds in 2002. Indiana passed their version in 2004, and every county in the state had to be in compliance by 2006. So Monroe County, along with a lot of other counties, have been out of compliance now for 5 years. So you have roughly a 45-50-year history of civil rights legislation passing, and we still are fighting to get accessible voting. I think part of the problem is, well, one, we're a minority. In the Governor's Council for Disabilities estimate there's about 15,000, 20,000 people of voting age who have a disability. So one, we're fighting this as a minority, and in a, you know, a democratic kind of environment, the majority usually has a say. But the other problem is I think people look at this as being a real pain. I think elected officials view it as something they have to do, not necessarily what they want to do. It costs money sometimes, which I think can be a problem. I don't think people really understand kind of the challenges people face. I do have somewhat of an advantage in that I've lived in Bloomington for 23-some years. 15 of those years I've had a disability. I ride at least once a day on BT Access, which is a handicap service that Bloomington Transit offers. The real advantage of that is I see every day people with disabilities, and I see a variety of different kinds of disabilities. I see these people on a good day, on a bad day. I see what they struggle with. I see what their lives are like. And for me, and I think for a lot of people, the right to vote is more than just a basic right. It's the only way, I think, that we can engage in the process and make the quality of life better. And you just can't do that if you're going to be outside the political process. My dream with this would be we get first accessible voting, and then we organize those 15 to 20,000 people. You know, if we have 20,000 people with a disability, if we could organize half of those, we'd have 10,000. We'd get half of those to vote. In a local election, we could swing elections. You know, my dream is we could be as intimidating as the NRA when we call people up. but none of that. Normally in a political process, you would organize first. It makes no sense to organize if people can't get to the poll to vote. And so that's really kind of where we're at right now. And now we've really gotten into the mix with – we've got two issues going. One is the November election coming up, and then the other one is the vote center discussion that's going for next year.
Now, did you say 15,000 to 20,000 people?
Right.
What sort of disabilities are we talking about? Now, this is radio, so unless folks have heard you on this show before and heard the context in which we've discussed these problems, they may not realize that you yourself are in a wheelchair.
That's going to include virtually any kind of disability. Normally what the law is trying to protect are those disabilities involving vision, mobility, communication, and dexterity. But it would also include any kind of developmental disability. And so the advantage when I talk about VT access is I see all of that. And every single one has a different challenge. And the Help America Vote Act, and one of the things that's so important on that is to get people who are inspecting the sites trained properly, is that if you go through this checklist that they have, it's about 8 pages long, it's structured in a way that you're going to hit all those disabilities. You may not know when you're asking the question or looking at the problem that that's what you're doing, but they're all pretty much meant to solve that broad range. So a lot of the problem is, I think, is education. I really do believe most of the public thinks that disability is people in a wheelchair. And I see it time and time again when we go out on inspection sites, people will say, well, that's accessible because a chair can get through the door, mm-hmm. or it's got a ramp, or it's got a curb cut. But there's a lot more involved than that to make it. So I think some of the things we have to do is educate not only our people doing the inspections, but also the public as well.
Randy Paul here on Interchange. We're discussing voting accessibility in anticipation of the election next month. Randy, you bring up a really interesting point about, you know, disabilities people may not think of. And when you said developmental disabilities, what sort of things can we do? Not necessarily, we'll get to what we are doing and what we have done and what we will do, but what sort of things should we do to make voting more accessible?
We have to follow the law. I mean, it's not, you don't have to go back to school and get your master's degree on this. The federal government, the Justice Department, has come out with the training tools, the information. It doesn't take a lot, but it takes a commitment for everybody to understand that it's more than just the obvious out there we're trying to take care of. We're trying to take care of anybody who's coming up with a disability. For example, most people, if they think of somebody who's blind, they think of somebody totally blind that they can see that either has the cane or an aid of some kind. The people who I find have the greatest problem are those who are legally blind, but they have some sight. And I've been in situations where I've actually seen someone, there's a lady that rides BT Access all the time. She was confronted by a person saying, you're not blind. And he actually wanted her to prove that, which was, I didn't have an eye chart handy with me, but I'm not sure how she would go about doing that. And so oftentimes those invisible disabilities, we had at one of the churches here in town, the priest was an asthmatic, severe asthmatic. And I was teaching one of the classes at St. Charles, and my kids are going by the church, and his car is out front with a handicap decal on it. And one of the kids said, you know, he's not handicapped. And I tried to explain to him what a hidden disability is. And that's a disability, for example, with this priest. If he walked very far, he would develop an asthma attack. Is he disabled? Certainly. Is it visible to somebody? No. And so when I was teaching in school, I thought one way to change things is to start at the schools with the kids. And I did a lot of in-class kind of awareness with the kids, because I found out that the kids, you know, they're great as long as you talk to them about it. And hopefully some of the kids will educate their parents. It's interesting because I oftentimes will go through a restaurant and a small child will say, will look at their parents and say, and whisper something like, why is he in a wheelchair or something? And the parents go, you know, shh, you know, mm-hmm. don't say anything. And they just kind of look horrified. And I'll stop and say, you know, it's okay to ask questions, because if you're a parent and you do that with a young child, the child then thinks something's wrong with this person. They're mm-hmm. scared of them. And it kind of puts that distance between. Right. And so
stigma. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm totally willing to stop and talk to a child about it, because I think it's good for them to be educated. So I think just in general, people need to be more aware. I think public officials need to be more aware. I think it comes from the top. I think when a community sees elected officials, and for example, myself getting in such arguments about this, I don't think that's positive from anybody's standpoint. I don't think it's positive for me to file complaints with the Justice Department. I'm sure they don't enjoy it. It puts an animosity there that I don't think is good. And the sad thing is we shouldn't have to do that.
You know, I love that you've got the story of the legally blind bus rider and the asthmatic preacher. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we really like to do in community radio is put a real face on these problems so that it's not some abstract thing that we're talking about. What are some more, tell us some more people that you know or that you've run into that may be in this hidden disability realm.
Well, there's one is she's not as hidden as she has a respiratory problem, but we had a complaint from a lady who was trying to vote at Reed last time, and she's on oxygen. I think what people forget sometimes, you see someone on oxygen, that's because they can't breathe. Just because they're getting around and they've got it doesn't mean they don't have a problem. And you have someone like that, if they exert much energy, like walking very far, it's going to trigger a crisis for them. Because when you're on oxygen, it means, I mean, I was on it for 2 years, it means you're not getting oxygen into your bloodstream. It's not just because you're winded. What people forget is that she described her process of getting out the door, and to get ready to go out took her 2 hours. And then to go, and it took an effort to get to the polling site. And then you get to the polling site, and you're thinking it's supposed to be accessible for me, and it's not. I mean, the best way I could describe it is think about a time when you've had a horrible case of the flu, and you struggled to get ready to go out because you had some meeting to go to, and you get to that meeting, and it's been canceled, and no one told you how you feel about it. Only in this lady's case, it's that way for her every single day. And I think people will think about it. Quite frankly, I think it's cruel for us to be doing that to her. I really do. And we'll get into it later as far as what's happening in November. But those are the kind of things where I think even if you see someone with a disability, you don't know what's behind it. You don't know the struggles that they go through. You don't know the history of it. And I think people just need to kind of step back a minute and look at it and say, you know, their lives are hard enough. We don't need to make them any harder, especially when we're legally required not to make them harder.
And if you've got an oxygen tank, you don't want to run out of oxygen in the voting line.
Exactly.
Randy Paul here on Interchange. We're talking about voting accessibility. And to the question of what we need to do, you said we need to follow the law. Well, in a nutshell, I know we don't have time to read every clause in the Help America Vote Act, but just in a nutshell, what does the law say?
The law says that by 2006, Indiana had to be in compliance. And compliance basically means for those areas that I talked about, those four basic kind of disabilities, they have to be accessible. And the good thing is that they've not made this very complicated. If you go through the training, you go through the checklist, if you do the checklist properly, you're going to be okay. But it's not going to be what's happened in the past is you go to a site and you say, well, there's a curb ramp and there's a door wide enough for a wheelchair, it's compliant. Because there are a lot of different disabilities outside of a wheelchair. There are a lot of disabilities in a wheelchair. Let's just take that. In one example, somebody in a wheelchair, let's take an example of somebody who's paralyzed from the waist down. You see them in a chair, and if they've been that way for a while, they develop tremendous upper body strength because they've been wheeling that chair around and they build up muscles. You're going to see those people go around town without any problem at all. There are other people, and myself would be included, where you have a condition where your muscles are deteriorating and you have muscle weakness. And in my case, I went from a cane to crutches to a walker to manual chair, and now I'm in a power chair. If I have to go very far at all in a manual chair, I can't get there. And so when, for example, City Hall came up as a possible polling site, there's no close parking to get in the entrance. And when I belonged to the CCA, which is the Council for Community Accessibility, and their meetings are at City Hall. For a six-month period, when I was transitioning from a manual chair to a power chair, I couldn't go to the meetings. Because to get to that, there's a sloping ramp or sidewalk, depending on what you want to call it, up to the entrance. And those are the kind of things that I think unless you can kind of get you either have some empathy either through training or experience, you have to kind of look at yourself and say, which do I need? And if you have no experience in this or no family member, the education should get you there. But an issue that came up at City Hall was I brought up objections to the fact that it wasn't accessible because of the distance. And so what they did is one day they called one guy who was what I described. He had tremendous body upper strength. They asked me if he had a problem, and he said no. And then they got a maintenance worker at the city building, put him in a wheelchair, and he said, yeah, it's not a problem. Well, if you put a healthy person in a wheelchair and you use that as your test, that doesn't cut it. I mean, I'm sorry, that's not going to work. And so there wasn't even a realization that people in wheelchairs are in different situations. So a lot of it's empathy, which I think is needed, but a lot of that comes through education also.
Okay, so you're saying in order to be compliant, we follow the law. Here's what the law says. Specifically going a little deeper into that, it's not just being wheelchair accessible. You also have to be within a certain distance.
Right. For example, doors also, somebody who has, let's say, partial paralysis, or even something simple, someone who has arthritis, the law says you have to have handles that don't require turning because somebody can't grip them. If you've got a building where there's anything low-hanging trees or branches, or someone who is blind is going to hit that. You can't have any cracks in the wheelchair or a sidewalk because anybody in a cane or a walker or a wheelchair will trip. There are things that people don't think about a lot of times. A good example here in town is the courthouse. There is a beautiful place to drop people off. I do it every day in BT Access. The problem is they forgot to cut a curb cut. So when I get dropped off, I have to get in the street and go down to the light to get a crosswalk. Well, put someone in the street, and that's not a good idea either. So those kind of things that I think people don't think about, but they have to be done.
Randy Paul here on Interchange. My name's Chad Carruthers. This is WFHB, volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio. So we're here with Randy Paul, and Randy has personal experience with experiencing obstacles to voting, and as you've heard through his testimonials of other folks, he's not alone. 15,000 to 20,000 people in this area with some sort of obstacle to voting along these lines. So Randy, back to the regulations, you're saying that we have this thing called the Help America Vote Act. There's a requirement for Indiana to be compliant as of 5 years ago, and you're saying that we're still not.
Right.
And so that brings us to where we are today. We have a complaint here dated September 20th that you sent to Jeremy Burton, who is the HAVA outreach manager for the Indiana Secretary of State up in of Indiana. And what prompted you to file this complaint? Why did it have to go that far?
It's been 5 years, and it's long enough. I mean, I have literally been at this for 5 years, and we've made very little progress. What really prompted that complaint was the next month's election in November, because if you look at it, there are, real quick, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 schools who are, that are polling sites.
Mm-hmm.
The person who chaired the committee, the Vote Center Committee, she announced at a meeting, I went to the meeting 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago to the election board meeting, and I pointed out that none of those schools are compliant. And the chairperson, who should know better, said, oh, yes, they are. She used Summit as an example, saying it's a new building. The problem with schools, the reason they're not in compliance, is that schools by design are built so that cars are kept away from kids. So you always have parking problems at a school. That's compounded by the fact that the school is open. So twice a day you have, it's like leaving a small sporting event in the morning and the afternoon. You've got, I used to do bus duty at Summit and Templeton. Your job is to keep cars completely away from the school. There is no way you can be compliant and the school is open. There just isn't any way. And I've been talking about this for 5 years now. And so when I found out that once again they're doing it, that was a problem. The bigger problem was I offered them a compromise. And the agreement I was suggesting is, for example, Summit is an important example because it's very hard to find a building out there that's close to that area. And so I was saying, if you fully disclose the problems at Summit, if when you publish your polling sites, if you put in there, you know, put an asterisk and then put a legend that says Summit Elementary is not accessible if you need close parking, then we warn people beforehand. And that person has to decide, you either vote by paper, you know, by mail, or go to the early voting, but we warn them. So the example I gave of the lady in an oxygen, dragging around an oxygen, takes her 2 hours to get out of the house, it is cruel to tell her in public that site is accessible, and then when she gets there, it's not. And all I wanted was full disclosure. and they won't do it. So that's why I sent the complaint in. So on one hand, I was saying, okay, and I was getting some blowback from friends of mine saying, you know, why are you giving them a break with the law? And I thought, because we need to get something done. But when they refuse to do that, when they refuse to even allow people to notice that it's not compliant, I've had enough with it. So that's why I sent the complaint in.
I have a quote here from the complaint that you filed with Jeremy Burton, and says, this is Randy Paul's words, says, over the past 7 years, the county and state have not only refused to enforce HAVA, but have actually applied for HAVA grant money from the federal government, promising to make all polling sites HAVA compliant as a condition of the grant, and then ignored HAVA once they were in receipt of the grant money. And we're talking upwards of $400,000.
Yeah, that was really bad, too. that was really bad. You know, the Help America Vote Act isn't just about disabilities. It was prompted. Help America Vote Act was prompted by the 2000 election, and part of the law says we got to get rid of some of those machines like they had in Florida. And so the federal government allowed grants to states to upgrade their machines. Well, we did that. We did that in 2003, and we got a $418,000 grant. Now, in that grant, every county council member and every county commissioner had to sign off saying, if we get that money, we will make sure sites are accessible under HAVA. The county took the money, they spent the money, and they did nothing for compliance. Yeah, I forgot about that. That really did tick me off. it was like, how bad is this going to get?
Well, I think some of our listeners are going to be a bit ticked off as well. And as we close, we'll close here in 10 minutes or so, and we'll ask you what people can do if they're outraged. You know, who do they take that outrage to? I've got another quote here from you in the complaint to the state or to Jeremy Burton, the HAVA officer, that the Curry Building has become ground zero in the struggle to have the county comply with the ADA and the Help America Vote Act. Explain that. How is the Curry Building ground zero in this battle?
It is by far the most frustrating part of the work I've been doing the last 5 years. Curry clearly doesn't comply. They know it doesn't comply. And every single year, they pick it as an early polling site. What's offensive is that early polling, part of the reason that they allowed early polling, why they passed the legislation was, the argument was, if not all your polling sites are accessible, we can at least make one. I mean, that's actually part of the law. And we can't find one site in the entire county during early voting that's accessible. And it's not. The parking is horrible. You can't find the parking. When you go in the building, you immediately hit a hallway, you know, going up with a high grade to it. They know that. I've been screaming about it for the last 5 years, and they will not change. And finally, it was about 2 or 3 months ago, I was talking to an employee of the clerk's office, and she knew I was frustrated. She goes, if you want the honest truth, the reason they won't change it is convenience. The Justice Building is next to the Curry Building, and the Curry Building has voter registration and all the things that they need. Well, that's fine, except breaking the law for your convenience and then making people who have a disability either struggle or not be able to vote isn't good enough. I mean, that is so blatantly against the law. And so I've been fighting that for a long time. So that is ground zero. And it will continue to be, because I don't see much of a sign that they're going to back off. Is early voting is at the Curry Building right now?
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with the Curry Building in terms of its accessibility?
There are actually 13 different things.
Oh, okay. Give me the short list. 13. There are 13
violations. Right?
Violations.
One is there's no way to drop anybody off safely. You either drop them off in the street or you drop them off in an alley. And the alley is like a minefield with cracks and holes, and it's horrible. You get, if you have anything other than a Range Rover, you're not going to get through it. And so you can't get into the building. The automatic doors usually don't work. They're heavy, so you can hardly get into the building. Once you get in the building, you hit a hallway that's going uphill. And so right there, you've got a problem before you go into all the other stuff, you know, things like the handles and all this other things that are important but not nearly as visible. Mm-hmm. It is an eyesore for someone who looks at a place and says, is it accessible? It is the most embarrassing thing I think we've done in Monroe County, that we actually know how bad that is and we don't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And every single year is early voting.
Ground zero, the Curry Building. That's the early voting site here in Monroe County. We're speaking with Randy Paul, agent of change is what we like to call him, and we made that up. He didn't. He is a labor activist, a current community organizer, board member of the Friends of the Library Foundation. Randy, this just to tie a bow on this complaint situation with the HAVA outreach manager, it's been over a month since you sent this complaint in. Has anything happened?
No, and it won't.
No response?
I won't get any response from the state. That's why I sent it to the Justice Department. And I've contacted them. They've contacted me. If I think now.
You have gotten some communication from the Justice Department. What do they say?
They're in the, you know, it takes them forever to process anything. I helped a guy do a labor complaint. It took 8 months for them just to get the lawyer assigned. So they typically will assign either a local lawyer, probably out of Indianapolis. The unfortunate part, I think now, this has been 5 years going on. There doesn't seem to be much willingness to get a political settlement out of this. I just don't think it's, I think if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. So I think Monroe County will unfortunately become compliant through the courts. And after 5 years of this, I'm okay with that. I think it's sad because what I was trying to do is to keep us from spending. I don't like the idea of suing the county you live in. I was with the ACLU for a long time, and we kind of locally had a policy that you don't sue the community you live in because it's taking tax dollars that could be used for something else.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried my best to keep us out of court, but there's a point where you say the leadership politically are not, they're just not going to do it, and you either have to give up or take the next step, and it's going to cost the county thousands of dollars in legal fees to do it. The Justice Department would defend me. I mean, I don't have to buy a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
but they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be costly, and it'll be not a particularly pretty process, but something's got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And when I offer a compromise like I did for next month, where I just say, just tell people the truth about the sites, and they say no, then I think we're probably at an impasse.
Now, what you just said about offering this compromise, this takes me to recent election board meetings, for example, October 18th. That was, a week ago today. And that is where you are on the record here. This is, these meetings are recorded. They're broadcast on CATS. They're excerpted on WFHB. And you say in that transcript that I want to end this meeting with one last point I made earlier. I've offered the election board a compromise, and that compromise is to, you're basically saying, okay, you're not accessible. You're not going to get accessible in the next few weeks. Just tell people which sites. That's the compromise.
Just basically. Give us a warning. Just let people know where they're going to have trouble.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is there's a lawyer somewhere saying you can't do that because if you publish that, you've just admitted legally that you're not in compliance.
Right.
That's my guess. I don't know that for a fact.
That was going to be my next question. Why wouldn't they do that? It seems like such a simple thing.
Well, so the other thing, since they're not going to do that, I would like to, since I've got people listening, is if you have a disability and you're wondering about a polling site, you can call me at 361-3302 or my email address is helpkidsreadmore@yahoo.com. If you have a question, if you've got a disability, call me and I'd be more than happy to help you with it. Someone has to give people out there a heads up on what they're going to face.
Randy Paul, giving his personal contact information on the radio. I mean, he's invested in this. This is personal, and it's also about community and about caring for other people in our community that we may never think of, and certainly do not put ourselves in the place of. Randy Paul here on Interchange. We've got about 5 minutes or so left. One thing I wanted to touch on here is you're following up on this election board meeting from October 18th, and then we have another transcript from the county commissioners meeting on October 7th, meeting on October 6th. This stuff is all well documented. In terms of it, of the obstacles that you faced historically, when you're trying to get change on this issue, a lot of times you're dealing with elected officials, and then the next election, it's a whole new, slate of people. You've got a new clerk, you've got a new, a new election board. Could you characterize the interactions, the difficulties that you've had in this go round compared to in the past years? Is it getting better? Is it still just a slate of deaf ears, or is there any hope for the our most recently elected officials? Are they doing any better?
Jim Fielder tried very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was in the same situation I'm in, where he's trying to move a process.
Uh-huh.
honestly, our current clerk has been much worse. And mm-hmm. I've gotten, she wanted me to return phone calls, answer emails.
That's Linda Robbins. Right. She took office about, well, not quite a year ago. Jim Fielder was the county clerk for a long time.
He's been county clerk on and off 16 years, I think.
Right, because the statute says you can't be...
He's recorder now, so he can't have successive terms for more than two. But he is the county clerk, I think, in many people's minds.
Sure.
I have to admit, I do sometimes bring out the worst in people. I've been critical, and I do so publicly. So I think some of this is personal, and I've been mm-hmm. trying to get other people involved to kind of put a different face to this, because I think some of this, particularly the commissioners, I think it has become personal. I think mm-hmm. they just, if you tell someone they're not doing their job enough times, they take it personally after a while.
It's Randy again.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's part of the problem, and I recognize that. But so I'm trying to get some new people to kind of take some of that, get a new face in front of this. If people really want to get involved in this, they...
Yeah, let's end with that. I mean, we've given out your personal cell phone and your email address, but what are some other resources here for people that want to mobilize on this issue? You mentioned the Council for Community Accessibility.
Right, and they...
A great city resource.
They're tremendous. They were set up by the mayor years ago, and they're basically... I think their mailing list is like 300 different people who deal with disabilities in some way or another, and they do a tremendous job. And the mayor, and all the public officials I've dealt with, Mayor Cruzan is the best. I mean, I can call him. If there's a crack in the sidewalk, I mean, he literally gets it done. And so I don't want to – the city government is tremendously good. The county government is incredibly bad. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but that's the way it falls into. So people need to get involved in the vote center debate right now. The public meeting is at 4 o'clock on the 31st, which is Halloween. Mm-hmm. 31st?
Mm-hmm.
At 4 o'clock, people need to go to these meetings and start talking about this.
Where's that at? That's Monday, 4 o'clock.
And it's at the city council room at City Hall.
Okay.
The vote center, the way it's set up right now, is a committee that was looking at accessibility. They simply weren't trained. The training, I've said many times, covered 47% of the requirements. So, I mean, they were going out there and they were working hard, but they didn't have all the information. And they're saying these sites are accessible, and they're not. And people, if you're concerned about this issue, you need to get to this meeting, because if that passes, we're going to do vote centers, and they're not going to be accessible for people. And so that's the biggest problem I think we face.
Okay. Any other resources, any other ways that people can plug into this issue and mobilize?
I would just, I think they need to follow the public meetings. It comes up all the time. Commissioners' meetings are important. County council meetings are important.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a concern, email commissioners and council members.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you have a very positive response from the city council included.
Mm-hmm.
But the real problem is the county. We need to stay on them.
Well, we thank you so much for your time, Randy.
Thank you. I really appreciate
it. The half hour's just flown by, and I do hope that that folks make that jump from just a passive listener to active participant and advocate.
Well, if I could just say one more thing.
Sure.
My youngest daughter, Samantha, I'll give credit to. She said she doesn't understand this either. She goes, "Dad, just tell everybody that eventually they're going to be like you." And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Everybody gets old,
uh-huh.
and as they age, they're going to need this." And I thought, the baby boom generation is aging, and so by the time those people get in their 70s. They're going to see a lot of these accessibility issues more clearly. And I would hope we would do it not out of self-interest and have to wait for that time. But she's absolutely right. Eventually, a lot of people have these issues. You don't have to be in a wheelchair to have a disability. Mm-hmm. Age will do that to you.
Sure.
So everybody may be dealing with this eventually.
Well, let's hope not.
I hope not. But
let's hope that we can all be agents of change like Randy Paul, our guest on Interchange tonight. Thanks so much to Randy Paul. Thanks to our guests in the first half hour. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. Executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. And we also threw in some tracks tonight from Booker T and the MGs. Booker T appearing here in Bloomington, his alma mater of IU. Stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.